The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. What's happening to our marriages in the Western world? We lead the world in divorce. And now the new thing on the American scene, broken homes where the couples are still living together. Unhappy, frustrated, wretched marriages where the couples tolerate one another and life is really not worth living to them, but somehow, because of the economics of it, because of what family, friends, and children expect, because of the bounds that keep them together, especially usually children, they simply are unable or feel they cannot bring themselves to get a divorce. But it's been revealed that gigantic proportions of British and American people would not marry the same spouse again if they had a chance to do it over. Unhappy marriages are rather commonplace today. The chances are you know quite a few people who have been divorced. And divorce is now striking almost 1 out of 3 American homes. Now, divorce is not a disease. It isn't something you catch by accident. Divorce is something that is the result of a definitive cause. There is a great cause, a great reason for divorce. There is a reason for the skyrocketing rate of divorce, and a reason why our homes and families are being threatened today, and that means our free societies are threatened because, as it's been said time and again, our homes, our marriages are the building block of society. The very basis of any culture is the home, the marriage, the stability of a home and a marriage. And yet today our homes are under attack. And it seems like sometimes members of the clergy, educators, philosophers, sociologists, even anthropologists who believe in evolution, even zoologists and biologists have a great deal to say about American marriages. And now teenagers are being told that the kind of a marriage of the future might be a system of childless individual marriages that are trials as preparation for a permanent parental marriage. Now, this has been proposed, and of course it reaches the magazines and newspapers, and I imagine many teenagers applaud it. Others wonder about it. A well-known woman anthropologist proposed this, a far-reaching proposal of the complete alteration of the known marital conditions in the Western world, a system of childless trial marriages, of individual marriages where the couple lives together but by mutual consent refuses to have children. If that doesn't work, well, then you have another trial marriage. If that doesn't work, you have another one. And then finally, if you discover the partner you like in life, then you decide that you will go ahead and have children. Now, this was written in a nationally read news magazine in the United States that this two-step system of marriage would replace the present mode of seeking for sex among a wide range of partners casually, then accepting marriage as a form of choice arising from necessity, created, of course, by out-of-wedlock pregnancies. In every social class, pregnancy is to an increasing extent preceding marriage, this well-known woman anthropologist noted. In the proposal she made, the individuals would be committed to each other as individuals for as long as they wished to remain together, but not as future parents. If the trial marriage succeeded, it would be followed by parental marriage, which would be explicitly directed toward the founding of a family. Is it any wonder people don't seem to know where marriage came from, what it is, why we have it? Did marriage have a beginning? Does it have a definite origin? Or is it merely an evolutionary or social change of some kind? Is it a passing phenomenon in our Western culture soon to disappear and be replaced by trial marriages? Or maybe we're going back to bigamy or something else. You begin to wonder, just what do people believe about marriage? What is the real source of marriage? Does marriage have any definite, tangible laws that regulate it, which, if they are obeyed, would lead to a happy marriage? Is there anything spiritual about marriage, or is it merely a social and purely a physical union? Now, without knowing what they're doing, many American parents are creating a new sort of a sub-society. Youthful, not only teenagers, but children, way down to 10 years of age, 6 years of age, that are becoming sex symbols and being pushed into pairing off and dating situations when they're just little tiny children. Now, for the past couple of programs, I've talked about dating and about American courtship, the prelude to marriage, and what's wrong with it. Articles in McCall's, in Life magazine, in Reader's Digest, and other leading weekly magazines have talked about the problem today, and it's about time we began to face it and to ask ourselves, what is wrong with American dating practices? Why is it such gigantic percentages of teenagers are married when the wife or the spouse is already pregnant? Why is it that large high schools have some 3 to 5 dropping out every month or so and having to get married? And why is it such great percentages of teenage marriages just do not succeed? Now, in a Life magazine article talking about the subject, it was mentioned how numerous sociologists have pointed out that the desire of young people to be popular, the desire to be in the in crowd, to be accepted by others socially during the dating period, often leads to a considerable amount of outright deceit. Now, let's talk about dating. Dating is being encouraged by parents at such an early age, you would almost not believe it. And when a person begins to date, he or she, of course, is on their very best behavior. They have their best foot forward. They try to hide any disagreeable qualities they may have or think they may have, and they always try to be different from what they really are. They strike a certain pose in life. And I'll guarantee you, hearing some of the conversations that go on in parked cars and at malt shops, drugstores, drive-ins, and movie theaters would really raise the hair on a few parents if they could listen in to what their children are saying. To hear their children tell it, they're a totally different kind of person from the kind of a child the parent really knows them to be. Now, dating is a sort of an attempt to impress and to feed the proverbial line and all of this. People can deny this, but they're just denying themselves and denying the truth of what they understand and know. And the trouble with that is that there are many evils in dating, a lack of knowledge about constructive dating, dating practices that are not only harmful physically and mentally, but very harmful and damaging spiritually. And many a marriage is based upon casual and accidental dating where the person simply does not come to know very much about the other partner or the other person. They've never seen her or him mad, never seen them frustrated, never seen them filled with fears, never seen their personal habits, never seen them react to correction, never had an opportunity to discuss anything of any solidity or value with them. You take the average date today, and what happens? Well, oftentimes, the motion picture theater. So the body reposes in any ghastly kind of form you can imagine, like as not legs and feet hooked over the seat in front. The mind is kind of a blank while the silver screen plays on their emotions. Maybe they're holding hands, and maybe they're feeding their face with popcorn. Now, this doesn't mean all of them are doing this, and it doesn't mean that feeding your face with popcorn is bad. I'm just trying to draw the picture, or to present the analogy, that the greatest killer of conversation in the history of mankind, the television, and novels and motion pictures, have resulted in our youth going on dates where it isn't really anything more than an accidental companionship, where they sort of drift through an evening and waste a number of hours, and when they're through with it, they don't know one more thing about each other, so far as anything that ought to be known. Now, maybe they know a lot more about each other, but in the wrong way. And I don't think I need to go further to explain that. But they don't know one more thing about each other that is really constructive, about their emotional stability, about their attitudes, and about their approach toward life or some of the important considerations of life. Their minds are dulled and blank while their emotions are being played upon. And there is a total lack of constructive dating today. Now, one of the big sociological changes of recent time has been the advent of going steady in the United States. And a great deal has been said about it. Now, of course, people are going steady in Britain and Australia and other countries, too. But America's sub-teens are being warned that they are headed toward trouble, and it's about time some of you parents realized what you are doing to your children to try to push them into pairing off at ages as early as 6, 7, 8, and 9. Now, that's a fact. Without knowing what they're doing or why or what the trouble is that they're headed into, many American sub-teens now, 9, 10 years of age, are being rushed into growing up entirely too fast and too soon. Take the 10-year to 12-year-old girls who turn themselves out in mascara, pancake, and high-style hairdos, and the boys who at that age turn into party hounds. They're going steady. They're engaged in constant campaigns to captivate one another or to be captivated. And the young boys and girls are involved in sub-teen romances, complete with wraparound dancing and jigging to a kind of obnoxious noise called music, and necking. The children, at least, are rather unknowing, victimized. I remember talking to one young boy who used to attend such parties at the behest of his parents, and he was embarrassed by it. He'd walk in, hear all the little girls all made up with their hairdos and some of them high heels and nylons. They're 11, 12. And he was scared. I mean, he was just scared. He didn't want to do that. He wanted to go out and exercise. He'd a whole lot rather been playing softball or basketball. And he told me the one time when he was going to this dance and he walked in and took one good long look, and then he'd get with another couple of fellas and they'd go out and run around the block. For want of something better to do, it was more exciting to just get out and run around the block. It really was. Than it was to be in there with somebody trying to encourage him to play spin the bottle or something else. Now, parents acquiesce to this, partially because they're fearful of bringing on family war, partially because of pressures brought upon them by schools, even by church groups, and by society itself, and, of course, partially because they sort of wish that maybe they could have lived that way, and they would like to live vicariously that way through their children. Now, psychologists and sociologists insist that this war must be waged, this family war, and they say that impulsive teenage marriages, a frequent result, by the way, of subteen precocity, end in divorce at many times in normal rate. I proved that to you in recent broadcasts and given you the statistics on it, and they are really shocking. When children try to grow up too soon, they actually find the real steps toward maturity so difficult that they may never grow up at all. Now, the way you grow up first is physically, and then finally mentally, and then after that, emotionally. And then finally, after that, some people grow up spiritually. But just because it's possible to grow up physically before a person's mind and emotions really begin to mature does not prove that young physical boys and girls whose bodies are now capable of reproducing the human race should be paired off in dark corners together and encouraged to do this by parents when their minds are nowhere near developed enough to be able to handle the newfound proclivities of their bodies. And many times, parents play host to some of these children's kissing games. For instance, at one particular party, when the host mother came into the room, the boy said, "Well, I hate to be rude, but mothers aren't welcome in here." She chuckled, and she also left the room. Kind of interesting, you know, 10 and 11 years of age, and they've got them in the room playing all kinds of kissing games. Now, some experts think sub-teen kissing can be looked on merely as exploration. But others will tell you that sexual excitation is a potent thing which a child's psychological apparatus doesn't quite know how to handle. It's kind of like overloading an electrical current, you might say, or a wire with a whole lot more electrical current than it's geared to carry. Wires burn out. Sometimes fuses blow, and sometimes something wrong happens. Now, you don't need to kid yourself. These things aren't true. I think you're about as familiar with the statistics, maybe not the actual statistics, but at least the picture, as anybody. America is raising a generation of children who make Lolita seem like Little Nell. And in Chicago, a girl of 6 goes for her regular Saturday beauty parlor appointment to get a lioness hairdo. That's done by combing it against the grain. You pull the hair out, and then you comb it backwards, fluff it all up, so if you put a strong light, you can see right through it. But from a distance, she looks like a mature dandelion. A girl of 8 wants nylons for a party so she can be just like all the other little girls. In Los Angeles, a boy of 10 picks up his date for a dinner dance, and in Denver, a girl of 9 wants to feel glamorous when she goes to a drive-in on the back of a boyfriend's motorcycle. This girl, incidentally, goes to a school where they start dating at grade 6, but some others insist they would like to have it started in the 5th. Can you imagine that? They're really afraid of raising old maids. They want to make sure their girl gets a man. So they start them dating in the 5th grade. Most 5th graders are about 11, sometimes 10. How about that? You know, an American childhood is going to finally be about as short as the work week. He's going to hardly know he was in a childhood. You barely get him out of knee-length pants if he ever even wears them anymore. And anymore, of course, they're putting neckties and suits on little kids that are 1 year of age. But you just never let him have a childhood anymore. Now, in a booklet that we have for you on the subject, there's a chapter about letting children be children, not trying to make them something they're not. Some parents insist on talking in great, long, two-bit monstrosity to their children and think that talking baby talk to them when they're only a year and a half is very abominable. They want to dress them in suits of clothing and neckties and push them out into parties when they're such little toddlers they barely are able to walk. And I suppose some parents winking at each other when their little daughter is telling about her latest boyfriend and she's in grade 4 think it's kind of cute. But if they realize what they're doing to their children, they wouldn't think it is quite so cute. Now, It's about time you found out what the teenagers themselves have to say about this modern American practice of going steady. Because they do have a good deal to say about it, all right. There was one article in Reader's Digest about it, talked about things my mother never told me. And another article in the same magazine that came from a human relations columnist on going steady, who needs it? And this columnist had asked the teenagers what they thought about it, had questioned hundreds of them. And after all, if you want to find out what the teens think about it, ask them. I'm always interested to see that some people want to find out what somebody else believes about something. Every now and then somebody's curious about what do I believe? What's the world tomorrow stand for? So they ask their neighbor instead of listening to the world tomorrow. Or they ask somebody else. He says, well, I'll give you this great scoop. I understand that once in a while a booklet or something is put out about it. I'll tell you exactly what Herbert Armstrong or Garner Ted Armstrong believes. Well, so will I. I'll tell you a whole lot faster, as a matter of fact, and probably more fully and completely. But it's amazing that people are this way. We just have the proclivity of going to any and every source except right to the horse's mouth, so to speak. Now, this columnist went right to the horse's mouth to get the picture about teenage going steady and whatever temporary social benefits may be gained out of going steady are clearly outweighed by the disadvantages in the admissions of the teenagers themselves. And here was pretty much what they had to say about it in this article entitled Teenage Steady Dating or Going Steady, Who Needs It? One boy put it like this. He said, I liked Kathy a lot at first, and well, I admit I talked her into doing some things she didn't think were right. I want to pause right there and state that, first of all, the greatest evil of going steady is that it encourages sexual intimacies which lead to premarital pregnancies, and 40% of all teenage marriages are occurring with the bride already pregnant. Now, if you think that is the basis for a good, sound, happy marriage, then you'd better look at the statistics on teenage divorce. Because fully 50% of those teenage marriages are going to, in less than 2 years, end up in a divorce court, and that is a fact. And you can prove it. So let's take a look at teenage dating, especially going steady, and find out what they say about it. He went on to say, after admitting that he had talked her into doing things that she knew weren't right, you can use your imagination about what that was. He said, now I feel like a dirty skunk because I've lost interest. Listen, girls, that's exactly what happens. You bet he loses interest. Because suddenly Kathy's not quite as nice as he used to think she was. Now she's a little bit cheap and kind of used, you know. And the locker room talk and the bull sessions among boys don't quite describe Kathy the way he describes Kathy to her. The way he talks to the buddies and the boyfriends isn't quite the way he talks to Kathy. And he admitted to this columnist in his own private personal feelings about it that he felt kind of bad because he wanted to ditch her. But he kind of hated to ditch her because he hated to hurt her feelings. So here he was, all frustrated. And terminating a close relationship in a humane manner requires maturity, and of course few teenagers are equal to it. And the greatest upset in your high school corridor is probably the latest breakup between the latest couple that were the latest sensation when they began going steady. And the saddest thing that can happen to couples who fall into this trap might be summarized by what a Cleveland girl said. And here's the tragedy of it. She said, I married Bob because everybody sort of expected it. Now, isn't that a kind of a pitiful thing on which to base a marriage and plan for children and establish a home? Because here are all the friends and the other boys and girls, and they're looking at you, and suddenly their opinion to you is very important. I don't know why it is, what it is about human beings, the sheep instinct in us, that makes us feel what people think of us is so all-fired important, we're willing to sacrifice our lives. We're willing to plan for a wretched future. To adopt the idea there's no need to worry, nothing's going to come out right in our lives, just so we can think that maybe there's a nice little smile of satisfaction or acceptability on the faces of some of our closest friends. We wouldn't want to disappoint them for the world. How many cases must there be of couples walking down the aisle and saying, I do, when they're only trying to say what is expected of them, when in their hearts and in their minds they wish they could say, no, I don't either? How many fingers are crossed when the wedding vows are taken? Well, she said, I married Bob because everybody sort of expected it. Going steady for 3 years, I had cut myself off from all the others. And you know, these early marriages don't last. Now, if you think that's no problem and you would like to be divorced about 5 or 6 times, well, have at it. Have your misery. If you can't believe the words of people who have had that experience, you take one of the richest men on the face of the earth, J. Paul Getty, who said he would trade all of his millions. And, you know, if he had a son and you were 16 and the son was 16, your mother would be after you to go get with that boy and go with him. And I think we all know that. So just realize for one moment, those millions represent quite a good lustful pocketful to a lot of people. And for a man that has that much money and that many possessions, to say that he would literally give all of those millions for just a happy marriage, there ought to be some measure of wisdom in that other people could listen to. You know, that's something we shouldn't have to learn from experience. That's something we ought to be able to learn from the wisdom of others, from going to the source, from finding out what is marriage, who invented it, are there laws that regulate it, what is the best way to have a happy marriage, what's the guarantee of having a successful and a happy marriage, a warm and a comfortable home where security and comfort, mutual respect, honesty, integrity, and love abound, instead of homes such as we have increasingly in the United States, where bickering and spats and brawls are the rule, and where, as you may realize, the incidence of homicide is higher between husbands and wives and mates than any other group of society. That more of murders, all murders, when you take the totality of murders in the United States, that the largest percentage of them are between mates. A husband killing a wife and maybe then killing himself. Early marriages are sometimes blamed on unhappy homes and the general state of unrest in the world, but the truth is that most early married couples started dating at about age 13, and then they were going steady at about age 15, and at age 17 there was nothing else exciting to do. They'd done it all. So they got married. What else? Is it any wonder sociologists say that sometimes they feel marriages are getting to be a kind of a drab, dull nothing with all the peaches and cream before marriage, and then after marriage it's just sort of a continuance of a noxious existence that isn't much fun for anybody? That's what they're finding people are saying today. Now, a University of California professor says that unhappy teenage marriages are rapidly becoming one of the nation's major social problems. You may think, for example, that the biggest health problem among teenagers would be maybe dope addiction, or maybe it would be automobile accidents. It's not. It's premarital pregnancy. It's the biggest health problem among the teenage set today. Premarital pregnancy and its rate of incidence among teenage girls. And it follows naturally then that the second major health problem among teenagers is venereal disease. And venereal disease is reaching near epidemic proportions in the United States. The numbers of people who have it are almost phenomenal. About time we took a look at that. 250,000 teenagers contracted every single year. That's a pretty good sized mob of people. That's 1,500 every single day, and 55% of all of the cases of infectious venereal disease is found in those under 25. But about only 1 in 10 of VD cases are ever reported. And a lot of times, some doctors and others are encouraged by the family to keep things quiet as kind of an embarrassing social disease. And a Dr. William Brown, who was head of the Communicable Disease Center in Atlanta, Georgia, said of the men with VD, only 70 to 80% are reported. 25% of the cases in New York City are a result of homosexual contact. It's fantastic what's happening in some of the big cities and now into the age of high school students and even younger. Any of you people listening to me, any of you young boys especially, you want to have it fixed so you can never become a daddy? You want to make such a mistake that you are never going to become a father for so long as you live? Well, just have at it. Have at the wild abandon. Do what the hen crowd does. Just give vein to all of your passions and become a teenage rounder and a scoundrel. Oh, you'll come to the place, of course, where after you've been the rounds, you will insist upon having this nice virgin little flower for yourself. You, when you're ready to get married, would absolutely insist upon having a real clean girl. But, of course, to hear you tell it today and you're dating, that's not the kind of girl you want to go with. As a matter of fact, many of the girls say, well, I've got to give in to all kinds of necking and kissing and heavy petting on the first date or I can't get a date again. What? You mean you're willing to trade a little bit of social acceptability and a date with that kind of a clod and jeopardize your entire future, the lives of your children and maybe their children,
and maybe potentially make yourself unable to have children, or maybe guarantee that you're going to produce children with horrible congenital deformities, just so old John or Bill or Hank or Joe will think you're a real good loose kid and a real good date and tell his buddies about it. About time some of you teenagers got rid of some of the garbage you're thinking about and got your thoughts out in the plain light of day and asked yourself, what are the values? What do you really want out of life? Where are you headed? You really want a good marriage? Or do you want a lot of chaos and calamity and heartache in your life? Now, there is such a thing as constructive dating that we're going to talk about in the next program, the right kind of dating. Who ought to be around? How many people involved? Where should it be done? Dating doesn't need to have romantic overtones. It shouldn't be an amorous experience. Dating can be constructive at a right age, but what's happening to dating today is rather bizarre and noxious and fantastic. And it's pretty sickening and disappointing, too, in what's happening to the children as a result of it. And I'm not going to be afraid to say it. I think too many people are. Parents are afraid to speak out and teach their children what they know is best. And even those children themselves admit to somebody else. Oh, sure, but not to their own parents. They'll write to Ann Landers. They'll admit to somebody else that they wish they had parental guidelines and controls, and they wish their parents would give them some advice. A lot of parents won't do it. The clergy doesn't seem to be ready to stand up and condemn some of these practices. A couple of them have said, well, I can't tell my congregation it's wrong to have premarital sex experience. Well, it's too bad. Christ could. He said, as a matter of fact, somebody who even looks upon a woman to lust after her in his heart has committed adultery with her already, and God Almighty says in the Bible, thou shalt not commit adultery. That is not only breaking a great spiritual law, but it's sinning against your own body, as God shows in the Bible, and is going to result in some pretty horrible penalties. What do you mean afraid to speak out against it? People are apparently sort of rocking back in their heels and giving with the tide. Now, this new idea of trial marriages is exactly that. What they do is to take the exceptions. It's kind of like what's happening in jurisprudence today. We find out, oh, are there that many criminals? Well, some of this is bound to be a sickness. It can't all be crime. So many crimes today are called disease. And so what we do is to write all kinds of laws, buffers, and protections to help the criminals get off, and your chances of being convicted if you do commit a horrible crime are getting slimmer and slimmer. So the same thing's happening in dating and marriage today. They find that increasing immorality is the rule rather than the exception. So what we try to do is to rewrite the social laws and make immorality and all kinds of trial marriages and experiences before marriage perfectly socially acceptable. But you can't rewrite the laws of marriage. Those laws are just as tangible as the laws of gravity, physics, the laws of physical, the laws in chemistry. You can't break them. But if you do break them, I mean you can't change them. But if you break them, they're going to break you. Wait for these articles I've announced on how to have a happy marriage and the one on how to solve family arguments. And I don't care whether you're a teenager, a young child old enough to read, or a parent, write for this booklet on the plain truth about child rearing and find out about it. The plain truth about child rearing. What should marriages be based upon? What is the right preparation for it? Now, these booklets and articles are free of charge. There is no price for them. How to Have a Happy Marriage, How to Solve Family Arguments, the booklet on the plain truth about child rearing, and the current number of the Plain Truth magazine with this article on President Johnson's visit to Australia. They're free of charge, no price, if you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.